Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Psychobetical podcast. I'm your host, Danny Kirkpatrick, back in Ireland after my after being on tour, which is very nice. I'm just up in my room. It's funny, it sounds fancy, isn't it? An office, and it's like a room in the house. And the rain is falling down outside, as it usually is. I often complain about the weather here. But I've kind of realised that, because it's right on the edge of the Atlantic, like you can see Craggy Island from my house, is because it's kind of Atlantic weather. Like the weather comes in waves. So you, like when I was in England, I was in the Lake District. It just rained like every single day for a week, and it was just this like constant drizzly, horrible, miserable weather. Where here it's it comes in like kind of waves. Like they have this, if they say like if you can see, you know, you can see the Aran Islands from our house, it means it's going to rain. And if you can't see the Aran Islands, it's raining. So it kind of sums it up. And people around here, like when they say, "Oh, the weather's nice weather," they mean like right this second. So it's so it's made me appreciate the nice little bits of sunshine. I've been getting my vitamin D, you know. I think I felt the sun on my face about 20 minutes a day when I was like pushing Noah around in his pram. So yeah, maybe that's a bit something to do with life, maybe, you know, making the most of the sun rays that you get on your face and appreciating them. So it's good to be back. I brought my son back, Ewan, so he's not been able to find any work. I think because he looks too young. He's 20, but he actually looks about 15. So I sort of brought him back over with me. So he's back living with me now. So he's, but within one day of being here, he's got like an interview. It's not like a fancy interview. Basically, we like printed off loads of CVs, like 20 CVs, and then just like walked around Galway and here where I live, like handing out CVs. And the best job we saw was working in a milkshake place, you know, where there's just like a guy and he's like making milkshakes, but there's usually two of them anyway. The guy looked like he was desperate for some, you know, like help wanted sign. So we got him to give him a CV, and then he, in the village where I live in, there's like a supermarket. So he went and gave his CV in there, but he got an interview today. So he basically, it looks like he might get that job. So been, the guy was like, "Oh, I'm only gonna give you the job if you're gonna work for me for 6 months. I don't want to train you up if you're just gonna go off." So Ewan was like, "Oh yeah, I'll stay here for at least 6 months in Ireland." And then Vanessa was like, "Oh, you think, you know, you and you can, it's not, you know, it might just be a crap job, but, you know, if you work there for 6 months, then you could go and get a job in the milkshake, making milkshakes instead." So it's funny. But it's a funny, you know, when you're sort of talking about talking to people, you know, they're trying to, you know, get these like great careers, like, oh, I've got a career in, you know, what do you call it? Not computer language, what's it called? Thingy learning, you know, like machine learning or something. But yeah, I have noticed though, like it didn't, maybe you said this last time, but did I say talk about this last time? But like in the past when you were a kid, like this, I guess I'm a Generation X person, so I didn't really get this. It didn't happen to me, but you know, if you're a boomer or whatever, you're like post boomer, whatever you were, you know, you really were like tracked from quite a young age. You knew exactly what you're going to be doing, but like that kind of probably started falling apart a little bit when I was like leaving school. Maybe it depends what kind of school you went to. Like you had like free university education and stuff when I left school. But now you get all these like poor like kids, and they're basically leaving university or leaving school, and they're just in their head, they're trying to set up the next Google in a way. You know, so it's like really like they're no wonder they're bound to fail. They're always getting like the idea of getting a job in a supermarket is it's like a humiliation really, but any job is a great education. Like even probably the worst jobs you get are probably the best education. Like we just had our septic tank emptied here because Ireland has the largest number of septic tanks in the world apparently. So every house basically has a septic tank. If you don't know what that is, it's basically a massive hole that's full of shit basically, and the idea is it kind of filters through into the water, and then you know whether it does. But this house has never had its septic tank emptied in about 20 something years. So the guy came round. And I was like thinking, oh Christ, now that is a shit job, like emptying shit out of people's septic tanks. And but you just have to get used to it. Like I used to go fishing when I was a kid next to a sewage works, and you do kind of get used to the smell because the smell of sewage doesn't actually smell like shit; it smells like something else. I don't know why that is. Interesting. But I was thinking I was going to start having a bit of a chit chat with the shit man, but then I thought he probably doesn't want to have a chit chat, like he's probably got shit to do. And I thought like, oh, I'm not going to shake your hand, you know, as you leave, you've got shit on your hand. He did have rubber gloves on, but even so it wasn't like you know, so it's like he's basically like an unclean person, like literally unclean. And but yeah, it's funny, like how I was thinking though, like if you got really desperate, you could always do that. But then you might find out you have to be really highly qualified these days, like have to do a degree in you know shit tank, you know economics or something. So that's typical, isn't it? If it turned out it was like really highly paid job, no one, you know, everyone's trying to get in on the old emptying shit tanks. But I guess it's kind of rewarding, isn't it? You know, like dealing with other people's shit all day long. I guess it's like. Maybe that's like most jobs. So hopefully Ewan will get this job, and you know, like it's kind of tough. I think it's like definitely tough for boys. Like no one seems to agree with me that it's tough for boys, but especially women. I often bring it up with women, you know, professional women, that basically if you're a white working class boy, you basically life is pretty hard and shit, and they all seem to just then automatically think of some middle class professional 60-year-old line manager and think that it's bullshit. But I think if you look at the stats, like if you're Jamaican heritage boy or white working class boy, you're basically right at the very bottom of all the stats for education and everything else. And but conversely, I think if you're Nigerian, if you're like a Nigerian boy, then you're kind of up at the top. So it's not to do with systematic racism, it's to do with other things. So yes, I'm trying my best. I'm trying to get him to learn Python, because it's one of those, like a lot of boys, he's kind of interested in lots of things but nothing really sticks. So I'm trying to get him to stick with like Python, and both of them are like, I'm trying to get him involved in doing like a YouTube channel, So he's going to be like filming it and editing it, and basically, if there's two people doing something together, there's more chance of it happening. It's a bit like climbing, you know, like each person tends to motivate the other. So when one person's like, you know, sort of declining in you know, in kind of psych for it, the other person's generally not. So, and Ella's started trying to set up some social media for me, but as in a separate thing. So instead of like me being on social media, it's like a famous person's social media, or it's like Andy's official, you know, social media. So, but that's mainly because I'm just sick of them going on about me having no social media. So I need to, and they're just gonna. If there's anything important, they're gonna just do it. Like, you know, I'm not involved with it. But if I do like videos or podcasts, it'll be on there. So I guess I have to do it. But I'm not gonna. I'm probably not. I just don't want to get involved in it because it's like I ain't got enough time. So anyway, so what's today's podcast about? I thought I should do a few questions and answers, and I'll zip down through my WhatsApp, my emails, see what questions and answers I've got, or questions. It was cool being on tour, like realizing how many people listen to my podcast. Like, it seemed quite a lot, and I got some really amazing, what do you call it? Feedback from the tour, like people saying like they'd not laughed that much for 2 years, which is really cool. So I shall whiz through a few of these. I've got one about skis, I've got one about ice axes. I've probably got some others. I've not actually sorted them out. So I'll start with the ski one. I shall get past all the blah 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 blah. This is from Jonathan. Anyway, winter is here and I'm looking at the X pivot binding to go along with some La Sportiva Equilibrium LT Gore-Tex that I just picked up, hoping to try out ice climbing in January with a friend. The question I have is that the Hagen site says that you need a flexible boot to go with the X pivot binding. And I'm curious if you have used mountaineering boots with a Hagen X pivot binding before. Will this work out at all? I am hoping that I can get some boot to do mountaineering, a little backcountry skiing, and do some ice mixed climbing in them. My main interest is rock climbing, and I try to preserve most of my funds for that. So any time I can use the same gear across sports is a plus, or at least for sports I only dabble in. Anyway, thanks for the work you do. I'm learning a lot from higher education. Your recommendations have never steered me wrong. Oh God, just you wait. Cheers, Jonathan. Right, so I'll give you a general thing about I thought about skis. So you've got basically sort of downhill skis and downhill bindings. So you know the skis and the bindings you go to the piste skiing with, and you have plastic ski boots, which are like heavy duty, you know, like your lower leg, what's it called, your shin are kind of, you know, pushed forward a little bit, so and all that kind of stuff. They're very, very heavy. You can't climb in them, you can't even walk in them. They're just for skiing, and the skis are generally, you know, like waisted skis, but the skis are pretty heavy. And the bindings are very, very heavy. And the bindings are designed primarily to release so you don't break your, don't get a spiral fracture of your leg and all that kind of stuff. So the kind of, it's a very, you know, the modern skis you would buy or rent from a ski shop are really fantastic. You know, if you get your boots to fit, they don't ski themselves, but they pretty much ski themselves in a way, like they turn so easily and your boots fit and all that kind of stuff. And the harder you want to ski, you know, you need to get boots that fit even better. And but they have no utility beyond going downhill. So if you imagine like a bobsled is no good for going like bobsled touring, because basically it's a big, heavy plastic carbon fiber thing for going down very, you know, specific kind of terrain. Like you can't go off road on your bobsled. So a kind of downhill skis are kind of similar, like proper downhill skis. So we call it like leisure kind of skis. Those skis are basically have no interaction with climbing or mountaineering. They're like a separate thing altogether, just for going downhill skiing. So then you've got ski mountaineering skis, which are basically like a mountaineering, like traveling in the mountains kind of idea, but generally with an emphasis on skiing downhill, you know. So you have lighter skis, and the skis are, so they're not as stiff, so that has a sort of, you have to be slightly better at skiing if you've got skis which are lighter weight and less stiff. They might not be as wide, depending what kind of terrain you're going to ski in them. They're generally a lot lighter. Like some of them, the top end ones are very, very light. Then you will have bindings which are much lighter as well, and also they will not. They can be free heel bindings, so that means that when you put your boot into them. So this is sucking eggs for most people. You know, you put your boots into them, you click them on, and you can either have your heel like locked into the ski for downhill skiing, or you can release the heel, and then you can your heel's free. So if you want to be like skiing on the flat or skiing uphill, and you can actually ski up pretty steep hill. Most of them have like a little riser, like a thing that you flick up, or you use the actual back part of the ski binding. So it means that you your foot doesn't go all the way back down. So so as you're skiing up, your heel is like back is like landing on top of an extension that stops, so you can go like 45 degree slopes and that kind of stuff, or even steeper. And those kind of skis are also designed to take skins. So skin is a piece of fabric that goes underneath this. Some skis have got fish scales on them, but generally not that common on this kind of ski. And you put the skin on, and it means you can ski uphill. You're actually quite steep hills, and some skis have you don't really need like a full length skin, but you know, most of them have like full length skin, so you make sure the ski is clean. And you generally want your skins like in your clothes, so they're nice and warm, but sometimes probably not, probably just in your bag. And you just sort of, they've got glue on them, and you basically attach the end, and you pull them down, and then they kind of stick on, and away you go. And like the worst thing can happen is like if your skin sort of pops off, and then you get snow on them, then you like kind of screwed a bit. So they can be a complete pain in the ass, skins. And you also get some modern ones where you have like kicker skins, which are much shorter, because you don't really need full length skins. You just need like basically where most of the load is. So you have like some shorter skins that kind of fit on with like attachment with like Fisher skins, and some other kind of makes have like a shorter skin. So they're good. And I've used kicker skins quite a lot, because they're a lot lighter. Like if you're going to put them in your clothes to dry out or whatever, you're much better having like sort of small skins. And you can also use crampons with those. You get like a crampon that fits onto the binding. And it means that if you're like traversing on very, very hard, compact neve, like they don't work on ice, but very hard snow, then it can be very scary. Like if you're on a very steep slope and you're sort of contouring around on your skis, you know, if you start slipping, you kind of had it. Depends on how good your edges on you. So, you know, you have like metal edges on your skis that are kind of very important for traversing and stuff. So some people might wear those on, wear like crampons on underneath, and just like whip them off and put them back on again. And then the boots themselves, like you probably want a ski mountaineering plastic boot, which will be a lighter weight boot that has more ankle flexibility, basically more flexible all over. Like it's, you wouldn't want to go walking very far in one, because they're not designed for walking, but you can walk a little bit easier, but not that easy, because really they have to perform the function of a ski boot, which is counter to what a walking boot would be. But you can get away with it, and you can do some very easy ice climbing. Like some people, like Nick Bullock and people like that, they used to climb quite hard they had very, very lightweight kind of ski boots. So, but even though you probably are better with a proper climbing boot rather than a ski boot, like you can climb, you can go rock climbing in your plastic boots, but you're probably better wearing rock boots. It's the same kind of deal. So with that kind of setup, like ski mountaineering setup, you can basically, you can ski into climbs, you can ski up mountains, you can ski down mountains, you can do like everything. So it's like the ultimate tool for traveling in the mountains to some degree, but it is kind of limited. So the classic thing is, can I replace the ski boots with plastic mountaineering boots or, mountaineering boots? Now you can to some degree if you are an absolute wad, a premier division skier, but even then it's you're going to find it like really, really, really hard, and your feet are probably, you have no real kind of support around your ankles, so you are very limited to what you can do in terms of actual skiing, like skiing downhill. Skiing uphill is actually totally fine. It's probably easier with that kind of setup. But also when you're traversing, you don't have as much control over the edges of the ski because your boots are too soft. Like I've tried to ski in like Olympus Mons kind of boots, and it's like almost like impossible because the boots are just too roomy. Like a real proper ski boot is like very, very tight because you want to transfer like every little degree of movement like into your skis. So skiing in boots, like you might think, oh, I'll go up to the midi and then I'll ski down, I'll do like the super cool wire or something, I'll just ski down in my like your Sportiva, like leather Sportiva boots or soft Sportiva mountaineering boots. But god, it's like fucking, it's like unless you're really, really good, it's like really, really hard to do, and you're probably likely to, because they are supposed to pop off, and they will fit on. They don't fit on all bindings. Like ideally, you want a binding which is like a Silveretta 404, or is it 405? There's a few different old school bindings, but they're not that dependable for popping off, especially if you're wearing non ski boots. So, like in that, then you're like, and those bindings are probably great bindings if you are wearing ski boots either. So my advice would be, if you want to, get a setup that you can go ski mountaineering in, like a medium pair of skis. Like they don't have to be a super light carbon fiber skis, but they just have to be appropriate for what you want to do with them. And you probably want a ski that you can ski on the piste, and you can ski off piste, and you can ski to climbs, and you ski off climbs, and that kind of stuff. So you want to get like a medium, medium weight ski, medium weight bindings that are going to pop off easily. Then you want a medium weight boot, like ski boot, like ski mountaineering boot. And then I would take that system, and then I would like really, really hit the pistes and get like really shit hot skiing dashes down piste and that kind of stuff. And then I would like, then you would like move on to skiing off piste more. And then you would, and while you're doing this, you would like get better at sort of ski mountaineering and all that kind of stuff. So when it actually came to actually going climbing, because another thing is you're adding in like a rucksack and weight and everything else, which is different to normal skiing. Like skiing with a heavy rucksack on is actually quite difficult. Or even any kind of rucksack is going to be, it's going to affect your balance. And then what I would do if you actually want to go ski into climbs, I would just take the boots with you. Take your mountaineering boots with you, and ski in, leave your boots, whatever, and just have a separate system. Like the saving of wearing your mountaineering boots in your skis is not worth it. It's like the risk of damaging yourself is too high, really, and especially a risk of damaging yourself skiing, as in you have a horrible accident, have a horrible crash. Or the risk of your boots not releasing and your breaking your legs or something. It's not worth it. So that's a kind of good system. Like one pair of skis I've got are some very, very short skis. Are they 130 centimeters? They're very short. They're like 1 meter skis, like Hagen skis, which are very, because they're very short, they're very easy to maneuver. But they're actually quite heavy because they're short. They're quite stiff, quite heavy skis. But they just have four or four bindings on, which you can put. You know, you can put like any kind of boot on them, really. So I use them with. I've got like a few different. I've worn with a few different types of like Sportiva, like climbing boots, and they're kind of okay. Like on a piece, you could, you know, I can probably ski down like a. You know, like a green or a blue run or something, but I have to be very, very careful. I have to do quite a lot of turns. I don't want to get out of control, because even just trying to do like a snow plow is actually quite difficult, because, you know, when you do a snow plow, you're trying to bend the, you know, get the edges to engage, but it's very hard to do that. If you have to do like a really extreme kind of snow plow, which you don't want to be doing really, and you're not going to be doing like snow plows very easily if you're, you know, like in deep snow. So you got your leisure ski boots binding combo, and then you've got your ski mountaineering kind of combo, which you can use for leisure skiing, but it's a bigger investment. Although you can buy a lot of this stuff quite cheaply off eBay and stuff. Like people are always getting rid of gear, and then you've got like sort of Nordic skiing. So the Nordic skiing is basically kind of flat, more kind of for travel in the mountains, but not necessarily traveling up big steep mountains and skiing down them. It's more, you know, it's like rolling country. So when people ski to the North Pole or the South Pole, they're not skiing on ski mountaineering gear. They're skiing generally with Nordic skis. So a Nordic ski is very, very lightweight. It's quite thin. So instead of 50 centimeters, it's like 25 centimeters anyway. But they're a lot thinner, and they're probably similar kind of height, but they're very, very flexible. And the bindings only attach to the toe of the boot. There's no heel clip at all. So you have a few different kind of bindings. You have like a pin binding, two different kind of pin binding where. The boot itself, and the boots are always very, very flexible, like made out of leather or some kind of synthetic material. And they're usually a single layer, unless it's like for extreme, going to the South Pole or whatever. And you have like a bar on the front of your boot, and the bar clips into a binding. Is it CNN, BCC, or whatever it is, binding? And then you also have like a more of an old school, which is a, I can't remember what it's called now. But it's like a metal flange, and the boot has like a square toe. There was like a welt, like the sole of the boot has like a welt on it, and that kind of goes into that, and it kind of locks in. You've got a heel clip. Now they're probably the most robust kind of binding that you can get. Like the pin bindings, like I've seen several of them break. I've seen the pins come out of the boot. I've seen the bindings break. So they're not that trustworthy in my mind. Like if you were going to spend $100,000 to go to the South Pole, I wouldn't use one of those kind of bindings, even though they are more efficient. But you just want something that's very, very strong. Like I think most of the bindings, like say the army would use, like in Norway, are the flange kind of bindings. Who make them? I can't remember, anything you're going to give to a load of squaddies who can't ski has to be good, because basically they would break it if it wasn't. And I've seen people who are actually very good at skiing break the other bindings. So it's quality control or something. I don't know what's wrong with them, but they do have problems. So your boots are very, very flexible. The boots are more like walking boots. So again, you probably want to view them as being for like walking rather than extreme skiing. So you can ski up quite, like in Antarctica, I skied up some quite steep mountains, even though I can't really ski. So that for moving around, you can ski quite steep stuff, even just with kicker skins on. You don't usually wear crampons with them, like ski crampons, but you can put full length skins, which you probably only use if you were like pulling very heavy loads up steep hills, or like kicker skins. And again, because the skins are thinner and they're kind of quite short, they're much easier to put in your clothing and keep dry, or even put in your sleeping bag to try and dry out at night. Like sometimes if you're doing like a big trip, like on Denali, like we've like super glued our skins on because we were never going to take them off, and we screwed them in with like little wood screws, so you didn't have to worry about the skins coming off. And like on Denali, we had Nordic skis because we weren't going to do any like downhill skiing because we had like massive boots which were like huge, hugely too big, and they. We actually ended up having to make, it's actually quite steep some parts going up, and we had kicker skins on, and because we had like 2 months food and a lot of weight, it was just too heavy and because the snow was very deep, so we ended up making like ski crampons out of a cord, out of like 7mm cord, so we just like crisscrossed around underneath the main part of the ski, and then that kind of that worked very, very well. It doesn't, if the snow's that deep, you're not like gliding anywhere. But the idea is, as you like on the flat, you get some glide if you're on, if you've got like proper boots, proper setup, you should get a little bit of glide as you're skiing. So if you're skiing, say, 1,000 kilometers, that glide would save you like a huge amount of time and energy. So it's all about getting efficient at it. It's more like running rather than, slogging along on your ski mountaineering gear. Now that kind of Nordic ski setup has no value, again, unless you're going to ski in. Say you were like in Siberia and you had like a really long flat approach through forests and things, maybe like 50 miles through forest and easy ground, then that is a system you'd want to use rather than using snowshoes. You would get there like, 4 times faster, and you would use like very little energy when you're traveling on flat ground in those kind of skis, because you just float a lot better than you do with snowshoes. So like snowshoes are always the last, well, apart from having nothing at all, like snowshoes should always be the last call, really. Like snowshoes are really only good for if you're in like really sort of dense terrain where, like, if you get steep, snowshoes are still a pain as well. They're just a little bit better than not having any shoes on. But like if you're in, there's lots of rocks or lots of trees and stuff, maybe they're better than skis, but generally skis are always better. If you think about the Finns up in, up in like Finland, like that kind of terrain, Norwegians are, Swedes, premier kind of Nordic skiers, as you can tell by the name. So yeah, very good for like mountain travel, and again, like obviously, like people going to North Pole, South Pole, it shows what they're ideal for, and you generally the boots are a little bit thinner because you're generally going quicker, so you stay warmer as well because your feet are flexing. Like once your feet are rigid inside a boot, they always get a lot colder. And the more extreme versions of the Nordic boots they're like oversized, and you wear like a big thick woolen sock inside, like a bootie, and then you wear your other socks inside that. Or you can replace the inner with like a closed cell foam, like inner boot. You'd have like on a plastic boot. Some people use that as well because the woolen inner boots generally wear out, and you'll end up getting whole. Wearing out if you're skiing a long way in them. So like beyond that, that's apart from changing it into your climbing shoes, and you have to, but you really can't ski downhill in them unless you're really good and you can do like Nordic, unless you can do like telemark turns and things. So you have to basically have grown up in those kind of skis to be able to skiing them like effectively downhill. Otherwise, they're just a bit of a disaster. Like, I can kind of survival ski downhill in them, but it is very, very difficult. And because your heels are locked in, if you get any resistance and your skis start slowing down, your body tends to then just fly forward and you'll just fall off. And they don't really, your feet don't really come out of them very easily. Your feet are probably more likely to just come out of your boots or something. So, yeah. So in Greenland, I didn't even do my shoes up. I just like skied along with my shoes. I didn't have any laces in my shoes. And that kind of shows, like, on the flat, you don't even need laces in your boots. You just kind of, you know, shooshing along. I didn't put any laces in because my boots got very sort of damp, because it's actually quite damp in Greenland. And I just found my feet being able to move more easily inside the boots kept them warmer than having them, like, locked in there. I didn't really need them to be locked in. And then you got another category of combination of ski bindings. So these X-Trace bindings, or the other, there are a few different, there's some really old school bindings, and there's some Ice Trek do a similar binding. And basically what it is it's a free heel binding, which is like a plate with straps on it. Sometimes the straps are made out of like ratchet straps that you get on a snowboard boot, a snowboard binding, and then other kinds. You've also got like split boards, but I won't go into that. That's a different thing. So basically, you can take any kind of footwear. You could take a running shoe. You know, you could take anything basically, and just put them on this plate, which is attached to the ski, and you just ratchet up the straps, and then away you go. So as you can imagine, they're really only designed for going on the flat. So the Ice Trek binding, which I've used quite a lot, there's various versions of it, but the most simple version is just a piece of polycarbonate. Is it polycarbonate? Anyway, that white plastic that's very, very flexible. And it's just like screwed in with four screws at the toe. And then you have like a strap system, a bit like some snowshoes have a similar system. You just put your foot on it, strap it up, and then away you go. But you really have no contouring kind of control, and they're just for kind of going straight. So if you were like going up to do an ice climb in Konya, then it'd be ideal for that, because you're just going along these like groomed trails or through the forest. But if you were going back downhill again through a forest, it'd be really, really difficult, because it's very hard to get any control over them. And like even with the normals, even, you know, you kind of need more speed, really. And the faster you go, you really need to have the faster you go, the easier it is. But the more demands there is on the amount of control you can exert on your skis. So with those kind of bindings, you there's very little control over the skis. It's just basically going through the very toe of the ski. So it's almost kind of impossible unless you're really a really, really good skier. So people use those skis primarily, again, like the military. I think the US military adopted the Ice Trek skis because people can put in like those big rubber bunny boots in them, or they can put in like leather, you know, like insulated leather winter boots in them, or almost any kind of boot. They could even put like a muckluck, which is like a non-boot boot, like a multi-layered sort of fabric, like over like a sock basically that you wear. It's not stiff at all, like a big pair of slippers basically. So you could put them in. The main thing with like the softer the boot, the more you're going to get pressure from the binding, like as you're strapping it in. So those are, you know, good if you just, they've kind of replaced the, you know, the Nordic bindings for a lot of like military or scientific, or, you know, people working in, you know, Antarctica or places. You know, you just give it to someone and say, like, stick that on and just ski over there and do what you want to do. So you don't need to train them up, whatever. The downsides are they don't, your foot is like locked in there. So you've got a higher chance, I'm guessing, of having an injury. So that's why you don't want to be doing anything where you're going skiing. Like if you're saying, I'm just going to nip down this through this forest with my Ice Trek bindings on, and you're heading down there, and your one ski just goes one way around a tree and the other one goes the other way, like you just wreck your knee, break your ankle, whatever. So they're really just from the flat. So you wouldn't want to be going up to, like, again, skiing down 20 climbs in those kind of things. But it's more for if you were living in a snowy area like Alaska. So they were kind of appropriate on Denali, because when we're coming downhill, like if it was steep, we just walked down the hill. And then when it got flat, we put the skis on. Because we had crampons, like rope crampons, it meant that they wouldn't glide. They were just almost like kind of an improvement on a snowshoe. So it meant you could kind of like shoosh downhill without the ski like gaining any real speed on you. So we kind of skied, you know, all the way down, all the way up back to the, you know. So it was a, you know, it kind of works quite well for that kind of thing. So and the X-Trace ones are a variation of on the theme where they have I think they're hinged, I think, at the toe. So you just strap them in and they're kind of, but they look, the Ice Trek ones look a bit more Heath Robinson, but they're kind of, the fact they're kind of adopted by the military probably shows why, that they're actually very, very tough. It's the same material they make those sleds out of, you know, like casualty sleds where you roll it up and you put people in it and you can pull them along. It's the same material. So it's kind of, they're kind of indestructible. The main thing though is to make sure you have full length. Like when you buy an Ice Trek binding or any of these kind of bindings, you screw them onto the ski. So well, nearly all the skis you're going to buy are made out of wood. They've got wood, or they might have some carbon fibre in there, or might have something in there. But you basically screw them into the wood. Now, I would recommend that you get like a professional to put them in there, because they really want, the amount of force that can go into those bindings is actually quite high. Like the bindings I had on Denali, I actually put in, there was actually a long screw and a short screw. I don't know what the short screws were for, but I actually put in the short screws when there should have been long screws. Now, they were only a little bit shorter than the other ones, but they did start popping out, which is not ideal, because there was just too much force. Like, if you're going up a slope and it ends up being quite steep, like in a whiteout, it's actually quite hard to see how steep a slope is. So it's only when you're going down you realise you're actually going up quite a steep slope at some times. So you're pulling a really heavy pulk. So if you're putting pressure on the ski and it slips, your toe is actually going to put a huge amount of leverage on the front of the binding, which doesn't really happen with a fixed binding, because your heel's kind of locked in at the heel. So the force is going through the heel. So yeah, I would make sure you get like a very deep binding, very deep hole. I mean, a very secure connection from the binding into the ski if you're using that kind of binding, and you know, make sure it's like, you know, bonded in or whatever, like, you know, just make sure you get the strongest setup you can. Again, like, you know, with that kind of thing, you probably want to put it onto a Nordic ski. You don't want like a mountaineering ski, unless you want like tons of flotation, then you would have it on like a fat downhill ski. But generally like a Nordic ski, like the skis we had on Alaska were NATO skis, which were bought for like 15 euros off eBay, and they're like perfect, because again they're like they're just classed as like a NATO ski, but they're made by Asnes, not what they're called, anyway, Norwegian company that make really good skis. Like the classic skis for, if you want like an all-round adventure ski for Nordic skiing, I think it's the E99. Or there's the E105, and they also have the like the Nansen skis. So they're basically very, very simple skis, really, but they're made out of wood, and they're very light. So if you have to carry them on your back or whatever, they're kind of very light, and they're kind of stronger than you'd think for something so light. But that kind of like army surplus, you know, those kind of skis. Again, they're designed for like very abusive users, so they're very, very tough. Anything else I would probably say to, like, if you, it's a very limited like if you're a really good skier, you might be thinking like, oh, I'm gonna go and climb this mountain in Alaska or whatever, and I will ski all the way to the top and everything else, but generally you just wanted something more for travel, not for skiing, because, you know, if you've got like a rucksack that weighs 30 kilos and your legs are knackered and the snow conditions are terrible, you know, it's like breakable crust and then ice and all that kind of stuff, there's crevasses and everything else, you need to have, I think you're best having a system unless you're a shit hot skier, then you don't need my advice. You want a system that's just set up for travel, you know, so you can go downhill on them, and but you can also you can do without them, you know. You can, you know, but really our skis are like the way to go if you're doing any like long distance travel. And like I wore skis, you know, in Patagonia and in Alaska, in the Ruth Gorge and places, and I didn't know how to ski at all, but I would just kind of shuffle around on them wearing just plastic boots. So, you know, so sort of a glacial travel, they're ideal because the chances to fall down a crevasse are much less lessened significantly by wearing skis. So yes, yeah, so I guess the answer is I would focus on getting some boots that you could ski in. I mean, I would focus on getting ice climbing set up or a setup for mountaineering, and then I would focus on getting a setup that you could use for downhill skiing, and then I would sort of mix them up if need be. Now, you can, if you have the right kind of binding, you can kind of force like a mountaineering boot into a ski mountaineering boot, a ski mountaineering binding, but you are going to limit your the ability for it to pop off if you take a fall or whatever, and you're not, you know, so but again, you're kind of limited to like the old bindings. Like you can buy like, is it the 405? You definitely, there's a 404, and I think there's a 405, and maybe there's some other ones that you can pick up on eBay. Like I've got about four pairs of bindings that I've sort of picked up over the years, and you know, they're good, but you just, if you're a shit skier, you don't want to be going skiing on a piste with 404 bindings. You're kind of asking to have an accident, really, you know. And you know, if you get like a spiral fracture, you know, you're not going to be climbing for a long time, and it's going to cost you a lot of pain, basically, have an accident like that. So you know, it's like a lot of things. If you're going to go skiing, just go skiing, and if you're going to go climbing, just go climbing. And when you can ski pretty well and you can climb pretty well, then try and amalgamate them to some degree. But probably still, you know, it's like, you know, can I get a kayak that I can, you know, that I can also use as a mountain bike? You know, could I like kayak to the bottom of a cliff, you know, to a mountain in my kayak, and then put some wheels on and, you know, like go up to the top and bike back down and then get back and make it back to a kayak? You probably can, but you probably don't want to bother fanning on with it because you just spend a lot of money and you'd be disappointed. So yeah. So I guess that's, you know, if you got any more, if that doesn't answer your question, and no, I haven't used those bindings, but I have used quite a lot of bindings like that. So you know, it's a like skiing is bloody fantastic. I must say, like it took me years to get into skiing, but it is kind of fantastic. But also, it's a bit boring. But it's kind of fantastic and boring, really. You could say like sex is a bit boring. It's like the same old thing, isn't it? You know, never changes. So, but like sex, you know, you keep thinking about it. Like, oh, let's go skiing. Anyway, so that's it. So, another question. Hello, sir. Very nice. This is from Robert. I was wondering if I could pick your brains about a pair of starter axes for mixed and ice climbing. Do you think it's worth investing on an expensive pair to begin with so there is less need to upgrade later on? Difficult to see through the haze of Petzl and Black Diamond marketing for a clear, unbiased opinion. Any help will be appreciated. Rob, so there's a weird noise in the background. That's when the... For some reason, this house, instead of having one water pump, it has two. So if you put... Anyway, so it's very loud, anyway. So, yeah, it's... I guess, yeah, the... I guess to begin with, yeah, Petzl and Black Diamond do kind of dominate the market. And then you've got your Camp DMM. Like a few other people making ice axes. Like DMM, I always feel that DMM are always like one generation behind Petzl and Black Diamond. Maybe that's unfair. And probably the same with Camp. I would say that any ice axe that you can buy from, there's probably another company I'm missing out here. A lot of them have seemed to have disappeared. Because before, when I started climbing, you had things like, you had, you know, Mountain Technology, you had, what else do you had HB, you had various other people making ice axes. But yeah, they do kind of, they too do kind of dominate the market. I'm sure like Camp ice axes are fine. I'm sure they'd be great. I'm sure they'd be good. If you get like any sort of good quality Camp ice axe, you know, if you get one on a deal, which you probably will do because they're always a bit cheaper, then I think Camp have actually made a huge improvement, actually. I think they really are. They are like a lot better than they used to be. And that, you know, I think they make like, you know, good gear now. I remember when I used to be the gear, like what people don't realize about gear people working for magazines is very connected to the marketing. So you would, you know, if you work for a lot of magazines, you'd, you know, say outside magazine, you would have the person doing like reviews, and you're often, it's tied into the marketing. Same with, I know definitely it's true with a lot of walking magazines. You know, often you'd have like the reviewer and, you know, the gear reviewer and the marketing person going around together at trade shows. And it'd be like, you know, if you commit to this much advertising in the magazine, that we will commit to, you know, giving you reviews. And generally, that's why people basically don't like slag off pharmaceutical companies, because they give like, you know, one of the biggest, you know, probably advertisers in, you know, modern media and stuff. So, you know, if you watch like American telly, like every advert is pharmaceutically, you know, pharmaceutical drugs and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of the, you know, but the, so yeah, when I used to go around was a gear reviewer, you know, I think Camp used to do like a full page advert every month in the magazine I work for on the back cover, which is like, you know, like probably the most expensive advert. And I never used to review any of the products because I didn't really think any of it was that good, really. So, but I think since then, that was, you know, 20 years ago, but I think they really have improved a lot, Camp. And you do see a lot of like quite good deals on camp gear. So I think DMM, as I say, like DMM are, they seem to me a generation behind. There hasn't been any like really, really massive, you know, like you often get of these kind of like offshoot kind of, it goes, you know, axes will go in one direction and then they'll just die on the vine. So like, I think things like carbon fiber ice axes, you know, it's just, you know, it's just an exotic kind of thing. You know, it's like, you know, someone said about like carbon fiber bikes, that they're basically a way of making plastic bikes. It's much easier to make a carbon fiber bike, I don't know if that's true, than a steel bike. But if you make a steel bike, it lasts forever. You know, a steel frame bike, where a carbon fiber bike, you have to replace it every few years, and it costs like 10 times more than a steel bike. I don't know if that's true, but it's probably, you know, with ice axes, you're always kind of worried with the carbon fiber ones, like how, you know, how they're probably great for just bog standard ice climbing, you know, on cascades and stuff, and they're very light and very little vibration and all these kind of things you have in the advertising. But if you're taking it to Scotland, you know, whether they were tough or not, tough enough for like putting the shafts in and twisting them and all that kind of stuff. Like a lot of carbon fiber gets very weak the second you get any kind of damage to it. Like if you're trying to put in a peg and, you know, and you miss and it like whacks into the side of your ice axe, that's probably not very good. I'm sure they're over designed anyway, but even so. So I often feel like DMM was one generation behind, but there hasn't been any crazy improvements in ice axes for a long time, really. You know, you had like the leashless axes and the kind of the sporty style ice axes with the handles and everything else, like the Nomex and everything else. But I don't feel like there's been a, you know, that kind of revolution has kind of stopped now. So I guess the main thing is, unless you really know what you're doing, then definitely avoid any of the axes, you know, with the, you know, double hand position, dry tool kind of ice axes. I don't know what you call them now. You know, you've got like a kink in and the handles at certain degrees. You've got like the mixed, what are they called? You know, so you've got the mixed version of the Nomic, and you've got the Nomic, like the Petzl Nomic. And they are really great if you're just going ice climbing, or they're just really, they are really, really great for climbing ice axes, but they're not so great for mountaineering. And generally, when you first start off ice climbing, you're going to be doing mountaineering more. So you can be doing, like, you know, if you're doing like couloirs, or, you know, having to top out through cornices or very easy snow slopes where you're having to dagger, you know, use the shaft of the ice axe. If you're trying to build belays with them, if you're trying to dig a snow hole or trying to dig trenches or trying to do stuff with the adze, or hammer things in with a hammer, like, all you can do all those things with like a sporty ice axe, but they're not as good. Like, they're kind of like an over, like, you know, a Nomic hammer is like pretty tiny thing. It's just for show almost, and you know, they don't feature an adze, or they're not very practical. They're just really for pure climbing. So if you just said, I'm just going to get into cascade climbing and I'm not interested in any kind of snowy crap, I'm just climbing ice and I want to do like mixed climbing, then like I would say like the Nomics are like probably still like one of the best ice axes. Like I used to be sponsored by Black Diamond, so I had like lots of Black Diamond ice axes. So I would say my feeling about Black Diamond ice axes is the picks aren't as good quality. Oh, there's Gravel, speaking of quality. The picks aren't as good quality, but that's just my maybe that's changed, but I always found that my Black Diamond stuff seemed to wear out quite quickly. Why that is, I don't know. So I don't want to get sued by Black Diamond, but I just found, if you do a lot of climbing, they're all going to wear out, and they're all going to get bent and stuff, but you know, if you start with a, is it a B rating, T rating? Is a T the strongest? So you basically start, you know, with a something like a, is it a Pulsar? What's it called? The Quark, isn't it? The Quark. Is it Quark? Better have a look. Let me have a look at my computer. I don't want to be telling you the wrong thing. So you basically want to start with an axe that you can climb as hard as you're ever going to climb with it, and you can do kind of basic mountaineering with it as well. Like, you don't want, like, they're not walking axes, they are climbing axes. Yeah, Quark. So the axes I currently own, so I've got a Nomic, I've got a Quark, I've got a Sumtech, and I've got like some kind of lightweighty gully things. So the one I've used the most recently in the last 3 or 4 years is actually a Sumtech, which is like a very lightweight kind of modular ice axe. Now, that is the axe I would probably recommend if you were just, so that weighs 470 grams, one of those. And you get, there's a hammer and there's also an adze version, and you can replace the picks, but I doubt you'd ever wear them out. And they're kind of so for pure mountaineering, you know, you can use them without leashes. You know, you don't need a leash. It's got like a thing for your thumb to rest on. And I guess I've climbing wise, I've probably climbed up to like grade five. Like, what kind of grade ice? Probably like three or four. Like ice climbing, like, you know, you are WI4, WI3, and but you do notice a big difference because they're very, very light. You do notice a huge difference when you actually start using a Quark or a Nomic, and the big difference is once you start doing harder ice, or even like easy, it makes easier ice easier and harder ice easier. is having the ability to swap hands, like on a nomic, you know. So you'll put your axe in. There'll be like a piece of ice, and there's only one piece of ice. So you'll pick the spot. You'll put your axe in, and it's like it's a good placement. And then you put your other hand. So you got your right hand is on the bottom of the axe. Then you step up. You put your other axe on your shoulder. You swap hands, so you put your left hand on top of the top position of the nomic, and then you take your right hand off and grab the axe on your shoulder, and then you reach up, and then you like put your axe somewhere else in another tiny piece of ice, and you put that in there, and then you step up, and again you take the bottom axe out, put it on your shoulder, swap over, blah blah blah. So it, and even when you're when you're climbing steep ice, the ability to like swap hands, shake out your hands, put them back again, put the screw in, swap hands. It does make a massive difference. But you just have to get comfortable, being on one axe, you know. So your axes are always I think you're crazy if your axes are tethered to you. So you're not gonna fall off. You're not gonna drop them. Like I did a route on Long's Peak. I think it's in my book Cold Wars. Long's Peak in Colorado. Like a winter ascent at Long's Peak, and I think we dropped two ice axes on the route. I think one of them, both of them on the same pitch. I dropped one, and then then Ian Parnell sent me up his axe, and then I dropped that one as well. So it wasn't good. So you basically want your axes attached to you anyway, and then you got like the gully axes. So that's what you want to use. Like they're even lighter, a gully axe, and they have like a little hammer on them. So that's what you want to do. What you'd want to use if you were going to go and do like, how much does that one weigh? That's 280 grams. That's super light. So that's what you'd want to use if you were going to go and do like Mount Kenya or, you know, like some sort of ski mountaineering kind of very, very easy. Like you can't climb ice with them. Your ice axe was bounced off. So quark is 550 grams. So again, it's like 100 grams heavier. Now when that axe came out, that was like the best ice axe in the world. You know, that was the ice axe that the real hard men were using, and everyone else had like, you know, Pulsar ice axes or, you know, it was a really kind of radical, it wasn't that radical. It was basically, a version of like the DMM Predator. So like DMM at one point were really ahead of the game, but they just don't have the same amount of money to invest in loads of like R&D and stuff. So I think they tend to focus more on making very solid, well-made ice axes. And let's have a look, DMM. And, rather than trying to like push the boat out, because I just don't think they have that, you know, it's not their, it's just harder for some companies to do that. Like Petzl have like, you know, 30 designers or something. So it's, so if you look at the DMM ice axes, so their equivalent would be the Fly Steel, I guess, Fly or the Apex. I've used the Fly. So the Fly is a little bit less extreme axe compared to the Quark, where the Apex is kind of. Again, it's like kind of in between the two. The Apex is kind of it's kind of a Quark plus and a Nomic minus, if you know what I mean. And the Fly is like a Quark minus, if that makes sense. So the Fly, if you were just going to do general winter climbing, it's like one step up from the Summit Tech. So like DMM have kind of got their axes kind of stitched, positioned in between all the other ones, really. Which is probably a good way of doing it. So, yeah. So an Apex, a DMM Apex, you can use that for daggering. You could, but it has, you know, it's got like an extreme bend on it. Similarly, yeah, it's going to be slightly more extreme than the Quark, but you know that'd still be a really good ice axe. And if you're a climber, if you were like a walker, and you said you were going to buy, an ice axe for climbing, then you're probably not ever going to be doing anything involving steep ice. But if you're a climber, then you probably will. So it's probably not worth buying something too low you know, low down in the rankings, because then you are going to have to replace it later on. So, yeah, so probably maybe like, again, like the Apex is quite a, I think it's quite a small, ads, because it is kind of more of a climbing, it's more of a climbing tool. Let's have a look at the features. Blah, blah, blah. Can't see it. Yeah, so you probably look, so look at, like, I'd look at a DMM Apex or a Petzl Quark. Let's have a quick look at the DMM. Like, look at Black Diamond. Gravel is a weird one. Like the kind of, I think Gravel is more of a, I'm never quite sure about Gravel. Don't want to get sued by them. I think before they were gonna, they were a long time ago, they were gonna sue me over something I said. I said that when they brought out the machine, which was a good ice axe. When they brought out the machine, I think I said it was like commercial suicide, because they brought it out and it had, these kind of weird dampeners on them. And I said, you know, it was like, it was mad selling them with these dampeners on them, because no one was going to buy it. And I don't think anyone did. So, but anyway, I don't think they like me saying that. So, yeah, that's the thing, you have to be careful with these things. Because the classic one that that Black Diamond did was the Viper. So the modern Viper, yeah, I guess the modern Vipers look good. They've got the sort of 230 quid. So the DMM ones are basically 30 quid cheaper. I don't know. I would, between a Viper. So again, the Viper's sort of in there. The Viper is basically the Black Diamond version of a Quark, and I would say it's like not as like it's got it's slightly more kind of high tech, like the shape and stuff. But you know, the DMM ones might be, you know, I don't know, but I think the DMMs probably have a better pick. Like I remember once. I was given like some prototype Vipers when they first came out, when I think the ice axe at the time was probably a Black Diamond. It was just a Cobras, just had a Cobra. So they brought out the Viper, and it was kind of aluminium, like aluminium shaft and everything else. And so anyway, so I got these, sent these ice axes, and I think I climbed, I had them for about 2 years, and I used them. I took them to Patagonia. I use them all over the place, ice climbing in the Alps and mountaineering. I went up the Drew, did the Drew Couloir and all that kind of stuff with them. And then I gave them to Ian Parnell, and Ian Parnell used them for about another 2 years. And I think he was doing like, what's that thing, Thingy Bang, Baby Bang, or it's called Baby, anyway, I can't remember what it's called now. And he was doing some famous Swiss ice route. And he had the ice axe in. He put a quick draw into the bottom of the ice axe. Then were the days you used to belay off your ice axe like that. He'd like back up the belay by like putting the ice axe in and clipping the ice axe into the belay. And he tugged it, and the spike of the ice axe just fell out. And he went to see Black Diamond in Switzerland afterwards, and kind of looked at these ice axes, and they're like, oh my god, these weren't designed. These weren't meant to be used. These were just for photographs. So they probably, it was all just like glued together. It didn't have any, obviously didn't have any rivets in it or whatever. So thank God. Yeah, that's, horrible thought. So, but they're all, yeah, you're not going to get a bad, let's have a quick look at Gravel. Let's see what Gravel have got on. Gravel, look at this, it's like live. Like Gravel are kind of, I think they're just a little bit wackier sometimes. Let's have a look. Black Diamond, Gravel. The Gravel often suffered in the past, like in the US, because of exchange rates, products, ice axes. got some wacky ones. Yeah, this got the North Machine, Light Machine. I've used the North Machines. Yeah, I just don't.
I just don't. I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling it. I'm afraid. You can get like a North machine. It's a bit cheap, 187 euros. I'm sure they're fine, but I just don't. I don't like the big chunky plastic thing on the bottom. I find it kind of hard to, if you're racking your ice axes, if you're like putting your ice axes into something, I find that's a bit of a pain. And I find they're not as easy to slide in. Like, a very important technique with an ice axe for Scottish winter climbing is, like, if you get a crack, if you get the crack that's kind of the width of the ice axe, and you have a bent, if the shaft is like curved, then if you put the shaft in and you pull on the blade, the pick, it tends to, like, it like torques the shaft, so the shaft like locks in into the thing, if you know what I mean. So there's, so in Scotland there's quite a lot of putting your, sticking your shaft in into cracks and things and sort of leveraging off them and that kind of stuff. So I would have thought like the North machine is probably more designed for kind of, you know, continental ice climbing, you know, sort of that kind of thing. Where I think probably, you know, the Petzl and the DMM ones, especially, I guess the if you think about, you know, if you think like the Apex gets a lot of it's got like a, yeah, it's kind of a good kind of shape, good kind of design. It's got quite a small ads, so for mountaineering, again, the thing has got quite a small ads as well. I always think it'd be quite good if they did like much bigger ads, is, and you know, because like an ads is a real lifesaver if you've got to dig a snow hole or whatever. You know, like digging away at stuff, digging through cornices and stuff, like an ads is kind of important. Also, for mixed climbing, and ads again is like super, super important for like torquing and putting in cracks and stuff. I guess a good thing about the DMM ads is it's probably very, very strong, which is it's probably designed for that kind of thing. What's the ads like on a Quark? Yeah, the ads is a good thing, like whacking yourself in the head as well. Yeah, I think the ads, it's like I seem to remember it's like a forged ads. I didn't say on here. So yeah, those kind of weights you get on axes actually quite handy as well. Like that go on the blade, they're kind of designed to make it like damp, you know, when you're putting the axes in, so you can take them off to make the axe a bit lighter. But they're actually quite good for mixed climbing because it's like having a nut. But the classic thing was like it's a nut on a stick. You know, you can get that bit jammed in there. And I guess they do different picks. So if you're just going to go ice climbing, it's definitely worth ice axe spares. Yeah, you can get different switch mountain, mix mountain ads, pick weights. Yeah, it's definitely worth getting an axe where you can put like a thinner blade. Is that a B blade? And then a T is technical blade. You know, you can put like a thinner, a sort of mixed ice climbing pick on it if you're going to do a lot of ice climbing, because you do get kind of wrecked. Yeah, so I think, God, don't let me talk in 10 minutes, Christ. So I guess that's going to have to be, I guess, is that in use? Like whatever you get, it's going to be great. And I would, again, if you're in doubt, go on eBay and have a look, see what people are selling. And, you know, you can, what were the first ice axes I had? I had some Clog Vultures. I also had like a Pterodactyl and a Snowden Moldings Curver. And then I kind of built up, I think the first proper ice axes. Then I had a Simond Barracuda. And then I had a Mount Technology axes. And then eventually I got some DMM axes, DMM Predators, which were great. And then I swapped them for some Flies, which were, I didn't like them as much because they were a bit quite light. I don't know why I mind. I kind of really like the ads on a Predator, because they brought out an ads which was like super strong. It was like a forged ads, and you could, I remember doing that route, White Magic, and you could just like put the ads in and kind of like walk the ads up the crack, like doing like a leaper cam hook. That was really good. And then I kind of then I started working. I was working for Black Diamond, and then I started getting Black Diamond ice axes, and then went moved over to Petzl and got Petzl axes. But they're all kind of good. But you know, they are. You do really notice a Nomic. You know, you do really notice those. You know, those modern axes, like how good they are. They really are pretty amazing. They do make a huge difference. But whether you'd really notice it, you know, I probably climbed the hardest routes as a climber using Vipers, which would now be seen as being like just bog standard ice axes. But it's just about being feeling confident in whatever ice axes you've got. And there aren't any ice axes that are just going to break and fall apart. Whatever you get, you generally get through quite a lot of ice axes as a ice climber, because you need different ones really. So you probably need one that's like the Summit Techs are quite a good entry level one, because you will then use those on Denali. I also used them on, I could have done with a longer ice axe for Denali, but use them in like New Zealand, use them on Mount Kenya. Use them for stuff where you know, if you're doing rock climbing in the Alps and you have to approach and use an ice axe, it's a medium weight. You can actually do some actual ice climbing with it. It will actually climb ice. Where if you get a lighter one, it'll just literally bounce off. You can't do anything with it. You have to kind of dry tool with those kind of ice axes. You want an ice axe where if you put it in a crack and you start talking on it, it's not going to snap off, which does happen if you've got one of these kind of lightweight aluminium axes. So yeah, I guess whatever you get, it'll be fine. But I would not pay top dollar. Don't pay top dollar for one that's low end, you know, and think of spending more money later on. If you're going to buy like a lower end ice axe, like DMM Fly, you know, or you know that kind of not lower end, as in not like the highest spec axes, then I would just try and see what you could pick up secondhand and get them off like eBay somewhere, or see what sales you got on. And maybe check out Camp, see what they've done. Just look at it. Just compare the, you know, what kind of ads has it got? What kind of hammer has it got? Does it have a kink shaft? You know, you want one that's kind of just curved so it'll slide into snow and slide into your harness if you put in your harness. It needs to have somewhere to clip in. You want one that's got a hole in the head so you can clip into it. If you're building a belay or an anchor, and then you want a hole in the bottom, something to clip in, so you can clip into that with your lanyard things and replaceable picks. They'll have that. And I guess that's it. So yeah. So yes. So a good uncontroversial podcast this week. So that'll please some people. And I have actually recorded my last show, so I shall edit that together, and I'll put that out next Friday. And a few people have emailed me to say they did reviews on Apple, but they kind of for some reason they got zapped. So it's still on 27 reviews. I need to get it up. So if you've got time, just do a little review, tiny review, like great, shit, V shit, whatever, V great, V good, V shit, then bang it on there. And then send me an email, I'll send you a copy of my PDF of like driven peg, how to hammer pegs into things. And until next time, I think I need to have like an ending, I need like an outro kind of live free. No, I'll think of something better for next week. Okay, see you soon.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.